They had showed ineptitude on a gross scale. Within weeks, hive aphos had fallen, and it was followed in quick succession by the thriving hives of Ledburg and Ararat. No one could understand how a small number of heretics could penetrate defences so quickly. Heretic had barely ever been mentioned in polite mid-hive conversation. If it was ever spoken, it was in a horrified whisper, behind closed doors. But now, many started to look for ways of escaping from the planet before their own hive fell under the relentless progress of the Scourged. Karkul's idealism told him that he should stand and fight, but he had put that aside when the Rinkenti household had used their connections with the Richstar family to get passage to the planet's central hive-cum-starport, Stellata. They travelled at night, as most hivers did when exposed to the outside world. When the thick brown smog cleared briefly, the sight of the sky terrified them all. Karkul hung on to his sanity as tightly as he held on to the frock coats of Master Rinkenti. They moved from trading post to Mindome, and then from planet to planet, as the Scourged swept all before them. But with each transit, the cost became more and more expensive, and at the shrine world of Ignatz, not even Rinkenti's connections with the Rich Stars could help them. "Sorry, Karkul," Rinkenti had said on the steps of the God Emperor's shrine in Ignatz's spiral city. "But I cannot afford to bring you this time. I have only enough credits left for my wife and daughters." "What will happen to me?" Karkul asked, and the old painter patted him on the head. "I don't know, but you're a bright lad," he said. "You'll work something out." Karkul had gone that night to say goodbye to Elipi. She had been crying, and Karkul flattered himself that her tears were because of him. "I've come to say goodbye," he said, and she stared at him, sniffed, and nodded. But she gave him nothing, not a smile, or a token, or even a kind word. "You better go now," Elipi's mother said, her hands on his shoulders, as she showed him to the lodging door. He'd always found her a rather stiff woman, but as he left, she gave him a pouch of coins and food for a week and sent him out into Spiral City with the words, "May the Emperor protect you," before closing the door. The Emperor had protected. Karkul found himself almost thriving in Spiral City, and through a combination of education, charm and a fast tongue, he ended up falling in with the grain merchant who was stockpiling food. Having stolen what credits he needed, Karkul blagged or bought himself passage from Rampo to Quence, from Ardsley to Bray's Watch, staying ever ahead of the tide of heresy. But Karkul realised that he could not afford to keep jumping just one step ahead of the enemy. He had to leapfrog deep into Imperial territory. Gossip in the Spice Mazar said that the Imperial Navy was picketing the inner worlds, drawing a line past which the Scourged could not pass. "Well, they haven't stopped the heretics yet," he heard one man say to another. His companion nodded. "If I was to go anywhere, I'd go to Potence. The Rich Stars won't let their ancestral home fall." Potence. That name had lodged in Karkul's memory and come to symbolise safety, rest, a place beyond danger. And it was to Potence that he set his sights. He managed to stow away with a lighter that was taking Munitorum families onto a defence monitor named the Bella Pock. They transited to the Prometheum rigs above Telkin's Rest, and then they switched to a vast fuel transport, the largest craft Karkul had ever seen, for the hop to the trading world of Mallory. There they docked at Orbital City, where the defences had been hastily reinforced by a pair of Dauntless-class cruisers in the faded colours of Battlefleet Cadia. Karkul had a brief view of them, their sleek shapes silhouetted against the light of the nearest sun. As he was transferred onto a troop carrier, it all appeared in order. But someone, somewhere, had taken an excessive cut, and by the time the stowaways were transferred to the Cossack Blade, they had no credit or connections to bribe the lower deckhands. They argued and shouted, but they had no choice. Ship law was harsh. It was void venting or compliance. The whole complement of refugees became allies as they were herded down into the subterranean darkness of the ballast decks, mile-long chambers, each one filled with putrid bilge water and toxic coolants that dripped from the vast brass pipes above their heads. At first, the lower deckhands shared their food with them, but the refugees were too numerous, too hungry, and after they beat one of the deckhands for bringing too little, the hatch doors remained shut. Without adequate food or water, friendships and alliances broke down. It was man against man, family against individual. Only the cruelest would survive. Karkul realised early on that no one was coming for them. Some of the stowaways had brought supplies of rice or flour or slab with them. They hid it as best they could, gathered in clandestine groups for hurried repast in secluded corners. Secrecy was their chief safeguard, and also their chief vulnerability. To be alone with food made you a target. Karkul's first victim was a young man named Awen. He was roughly Karkul's own age, with a nervous voice and wide blue eyes, and claimed to be a silk merchant from Stanbol. Karkul had spoken to him many times before their transfer to the Cossack Blade. They'd even played regicide together. But that was before, and this was now. Karkul had lain on a narrow shelf and waited for Awen to make the usual trip back from the water tap. Awen had splashed his way under the frigid coolant pipes, moving surreptitiously like a thief. Then there was a pause, and in the darkness, Karkul heard the unmistakable wet sound of eating, of food being bitten and chewed and swallowed. Karkul had been so hungry then that his first reaction was that Awen had betrayed him. In his fury, his fingers had tightened over the end of a rusted iron bar that he kept as a weapon against other predators. Awen was eating, Karkul raged, without sharing. In his madness, he leant forward and peered down. Awen was hunched over a leather bag that he held to his mouth. The sound of a bar hitting a human head had surprised Karkul. It was a dull, muffled thud, followed by a splash as the other lad hit the water. And then it was done. It was that easy. Karkul slid down ankle deep in bilge water. Awen's muscles twitched, but he did not rise, and soon he lay altogether still. Karkul found the bag of rations floating a few feet away. The hard-baked ship biscuit was sodden, but he did not care. It was food. He swallowed it all, but his stomach growled for more, and there was no more to give it. He needed more. That night, Karkul's guts rebelled against the food that he had murdered for, as if a hand were wringing them out. When Awan's body was found, there had been an outcry. Karkul had joined in with the others. He had wept and silently sworn that he would not kill again. But after two more days of hunger, his stomach spoke louder than his guilt. Next time, he was less cautious. "Give me that food," he had hissed, as he came upon a short, balding man hidden in a dark corner of the bilge tanks. The man's name was Frost, or something like that. Karkul couldn't remember exactly. Frost had been a Drago man operating out of Orbital City who had cashed in his silk futures at the right moment. A man who had got lucky. Like Karkul himself, Until his luck ran out, of course, when Karkul decided to kill him. "I'll make it quick," Karkul had promised, but Frost had turned to run, splashing through the water, and Karkul had rushed after him. It had been a desperate pursuit, under pipes, over sumps, along a tunnel that forced Karkul to bend double, Frost shouting all the time for help. The chase ended when Frost tripped. There was a noisy splash, and Karkul was on him before he could stand. "Please!" Frost had gasped, his voice echoing along the endless pipes, but no aid came. "Shut up!" Karkul had hissed. The bar had broken Frost's arm as he tried to protect his head. The arm bone broke in three places, and the man's hand flopped uselessly. Karkul didn't finish it immediately. He was angry and frightened, and his fear made him lash out. Blood gouted from Frost's mouth as Karkul ate the Draugr man's food. Frost's mouth bubbled red as he tried to speak. "Shut up," Karkul said again, as he crouched by Frost's head. Frost's eyes were closed. The word was faint. "Did you say mother?" Karkul demanded. The word came again. It made Karkul angry. "We all want our mothers," Karkul had told him, licking the crumbs from his fingers. But he felt guilty now, and took Frost's head and forced it under the water. A few bubbles rose. Karkul did not want to know what words were being said beneath the water. He could not bear this thing that he had become, and he held Frost's head down until the bubble stopped, and then cursed all mothers, especially his own, for dying so young. Karkul became a ghost, a haunter, a hunter. He became less human and more animal, and in the weeks that followed, there were many others that Karkul killed, the weak, the old, the unlucky. Afterwards, the guilt pains racked him. He was not proud, but there was no other way. He had to survive until the ship arrived at Potence, and then they would open the bilge gates and let them out and he would be safe. Maybe he could go back to grinding paints and even painting for himself. He entertained himself by imagining Elope. How chance would throw them together again, how she would have fallen on hard times that he could save her from, that it would all turn out all right in the end. The fantasy ending was powerful and compulsive. Karkul believed in it as devoutly as a religion. Something better would come. The days, if there were such things in the madness of the warp, merged into each other. But at some point in the journey, he heard the whine of the Gela drive powering down, and then the dull roar of the engines as the plasma drives woke. Understanding washed through him like warmth after a long winter. He heard the gurgle of coolant in the pipes above. Heat returned, and the bilge decks began to steam, and the air became a stinking sauna of noxious gas. The water pipes had long since run dry, and gangs now ran the water licks, so he was forced to suck condensation off the walls until his tongue was stained with rust and oil. After a period of darkness that might have been days or weeks, there were new sounds from above, the thuds and clangs of lifts operating across the ship. He grew giddy then. He pictured Elope and swore on her soul that he would not kill again for food. He held on to her image as day by day the sounds of activity came deeper into the belly of the ship. At last, the sound was of many footsteps descending a metal staircase above his head. He put his hand to the low ceiling. He could feel the vibrations. There were people on the deck just above where he stood. He could feel their footfalls, could hear the muffled banter as they tried the bilge hatches. The human within him began to return. He started to speak again, and when ship ratings brought abhumans down to pry the heat-distorted hatches open, Karkle could feel the heavy thud of their feet, could hear the moans and dull thunder of their hobnailed boots. He shouted up, "I'm here! I'm here!" His voice sounded thin as it echoed through the long chambers. It rang back to him from left and right. "Let me out!" he shouted, and the words came back as if from 100 voices, and he started weeping and screaming. When the light came, it was like a stiletto blade to his eyes. He howled with pain and put up his hands as if to ward off a blow. Tears flooded down his face as he fell back.
"I'm here,"
he croaked, and then he felt a hand on his. "Up you come," a voice said, and hands reached down and pulled him up from the darkness. Chapter 6. At intake barracks, Menka was still getting used to the idea of her promotion. "So what happens next?" Menka asked Dido.
"You have to report to regimental officers. Sparker will want to talk to you, give you a little pep talk, make sure you're the right material for command and all."
The regimental officers were still being set up at the north side of the barrack square. Major Kastelek strode inside with a trail of adjutants and officials hurrying behind him. In his wake, there was the usual assortment of injured guardsmen, sentry details and uncertain troopers holding forms that needed filling in and marking with appropriate stamps. Minka mounted the steps. Two grunts from A Company were standing at attention. She saluted them and passed inside, put her shoulders back as she caught sight of Colonel Beethov. He was a broad block of a man, with a strong jaw and the look of a man who was content to send his forces into a meat grinder if it would bring a speedy victory. But he was liked as well, because he didn't waste lives unnecessarily. At this moment he was striding down the corridor to his office. His presence only added to the atmosphere of nervous bustle. His voice echoed off the walls. It conveyed a sense of stress and growing irritation.
"We're the first Imperial presence on Portence," he was arguing. "So we're directing the defence of the entire system, at the same time as we're reorganising the entire regiment. Did anyone think this through?"
If anyone answered, Minka didn't hear it. But then she heard Beethoven's voice again.
"Well, thank Throne for that."
Minka found it hard to feel much relief at Beethoven's exclamation. In times of war, populations looked to the Cadians to bring backbone and discipline. Just their presence helped settle the nerves of unsteady governors and local auxiliaries. But if the 101st were spearheading the defence of the whole war zone, then that meant a stack of extra administrative detail to wade through. Intelligence reports, surveys of local loyalties, faction analysis, strength of defence networks, abilities of local commanders and troops. 3 years ago, the 101st had managed such crises well, but now, having been decimated in repeated campaigns, it would be a tall order, even for Cadians. She suddenly realised why she had been promoted. A voice in her head said it was not because of her skill or ability, it was because everyone else was dead, and they'd finally started reaching down to the bottom of the pit. She gritted her teeth and tried to dismiss this fear, but it clung to her. She tried to find her company office. No one knew where it was. Hectic confusion reigned. The 101st was being brought back to full fighting strength with the scraps of 4 regiments. Clerks and administrative staff were trying to find desk space, while the top brass were starting to dig through precarious stacks of brown card files. Almost everyone of rank had just been promoted or delegated dead men's duties. Newly promoted captains and lieutenants met their military secretaries, and tried to get a grip on their new administrative responsibilities. At last, she found M Company's desk. It was at the far end of the corridor, behind the ornate brass samovar, which had a yellowed paper note slung about the tap that read, "Awaiting repair." The desk was a camp table with thin legs and a battered wooden surface. Sitting behind it was Sergeant Tyson. He was talking to Putben. Minka had come across Putben in the Medicaid wards. He'd broken his arm on Marquis, and it was still in a sling. He'd been made sergeant as well. Clearly he was not pleased with the appointment. He had stooped shoulders, stripped unit badges, and a day's stubble. They exchanged words as Minka took her place behind Putben, and she heard Tyson's response. "Listen, we're all dealing with shit up to our necks. You're nothing special. Now get in there and see Colonel Sparker." Sergeant Tyson was a short, muscled man with a shaved head and strong, jutting chin, his meaty fists held together on a leather-topped desk. His violet eyes had cold, clear centres with shocking dark rims and long lashes. Minka stepped forward and saluted. He had a hard look in his eyes. He reached for a file at the side of the desk. "So, you've heard," he said with no warmth in his voice, leafing through for the sheet he wanted. At last he pulled it out and gave it to her. A list of names and a brown paper bag with 101st insignia badges. "These are your troopers. Get them to stitch these on today. We've been sent some real dregs. See what you can do with them. The commissars are edgy. I don't want any of M Company to be shot. Understand?" Tyson gave Minka a short, hard look. His pale eyes were chilling. She understood perfectly. Tyson nodded towards the platoon office. "As soon as Putben is done, get in there." Putben's face was even redder when he came out. "Friggin' mess this is," he muttered as Minka stepped forward, knocked smartly, and waited for the call. When she stepped inside, Colonel Sparker was sitting at his desk, looking in a drawer. He had a frustrated expression on his face, as if he had just lost something. "Come in," he waved, and stood up. "You're Arminka Lesk, sir. I've just been transferred to M Company." He shook her hand, a perfunctory gesture, and waved her to sit down. "Please," he said. "So, as you know, we're returning the regiment to full strength. Officers are from the 101st. Troops are largely from restructured units. We've troopers from three regiments. I think you have 11 troopers in your squad. No, 12. He held up a piece of paper to read through the list. "That's not normal, sir." He sighed. "Nothing is normal at the moment, Lesk." She nodded. "I've met some of the new lot already." He read her face. Yes. Luckily, we've got time to get them into shape. That's what I want you to do. I need them ready when the Emperor calls. You were on Cadia, weren't you?" Minka's face flushed despite herself. "Yes, sir." There was a pause. "Everyone here seems pretty panicked. How long do we have until the forces of heresy are here? I mean, we were told that this was a peaceful place." "Yes." He took in a deep breath. "Unfortunately, we have less time than we were led to believe. Much less. While we were in transit, the forces of the heretics have made unprecedented advances. Nothing immediate to worry about, of course. The Imperial Navy have a squadron of cruisers that have thrown a picket across the Delax Gap, and the battleship Admiral Pessequid is leading a squadron from Battlefleet Terror to reinforce them."
"Battlefleet Terror? Is that normal?"
"As I said, nothing is normal." He paused. "Think of it as a sign of the strategic importance that is now being placed on the Gallows Cluster. In a month or so, there will be hundreds of regiments arriving. What we have to do is to make sure things are organised before they get here so they can hit the ground running.
What you have to do is to make sure you get your squad battle fit. Understood?
Yes, sir.
Good. He half stood and put out his hand to shake and spoke in a faintly jocular tone. Well done. Take command and remind them what it means to be Cadian. Minka saluted and left. She walked back to the barracks and took out the paper, looking at the names of her new squad. Corporal Arctur, Troopers Bellus, Drino, Emerson, Jaramir, Jason, Lasmon, Donson, Rustem, Silas, Thaddeus and Victor. She checked their backgrounds. 2 had come from the Black Dragons, 6 from the 966 Rifles and 3 from the Red Skulls. Victor was the only other trooper from the 101st. He'd come from 1st Platoon. He seemed solid enough. She folded the paper and slipped it back into her breast pocket. At that moment, they were just names on a list, but already she felt protective of them. She found herself suddenly full of opinions about the kind of squad she wanted to lead. They should be the toughest, the smartest, the fittest. She paused and took a deep breath. They should be the fiercest freckers in the segmentum, this side of the Cicatrix Maledictum. There was a brief ceremony that evening at 2100 hours. Minka was in a line of 10 newly appointed officers in the pool of light outside the HQ entrance. They stood at ease before the flagstaff, where the 101st banner hung in the still, warm air. The bells of the cathedral started to ring, and Sergeant Tyson had to raise his voice to be heard. They snapped to attention as Colonel Sparker stepped out. He moved down the line. Minka ground her teeth together as he stopped before her. Tyson stood at the Colonel's side as he pinned the 3 stripes onto her left arm. She felt the emotion rise within her and bit the inside of her cheek, returned the Colonel's salute. As Colonel Sparker moved along to the last of the promoted officers, Minka looked down at the 3 embroidered chevrons and felt a dreadful responsibility. It was as if the Emperor himself were standing behind her, judging her, finding her lacking. At the end, Confessor Kerim arrived to give them all the Emperor's benediction. Kerim was a short, bearded man with wide-set, intense brown eyes. He had been born on Tolokan, chief hive of Macarius, and his arms were covered in tattoos that chronicled his rise from indentured labourer to his final position as armsman, first class, on board the Vengeance-class cruiser Vigilante Eternus of Battlefleet Cadia. But he had never satisfactorily explained how he'd gone from armsman to confessor. He moved along the line with raised fingers and a quick mumbled prayer. After a few muttered words in High Gothic, he said, "So, you got stripes, Sergeant Lesk?" Minka nodded. "You don't seem pleased." "I am," she said. "But?" "Well, I got the new lot."
"And that's bad?"
"Some of them are. Haven't you seen them?"
"No, not yet. They've been in political training all day."
"With the bats?" Bats was the name that the Cadians gave the members of the Commissariat. It was the Commissar's role to enforce devotion to the Emperor and iron discipline.
"Were any of them shot?"
"Not that I heard of."
"Shame. I met a frecker yesterday on Grinweed."
The Confessor pulled a face. "Oh dear. I have them tomorrow for basic scripture. The Emperor is my shield and my sword and my bayonet, all that stuff."
"Yes."
He nodded to himself and said, "Well, good luck." Next morning, there was a general kit inspection. The regiment paraded in company order. M Company were due to parade at midday. Minka found her troopers after breakfast. She shook the hands of each of them and said, "Welcome to the 101st, and gave them their badges. "I want these on by parade. Understood? Each of them had nodded. A few seemed pleased, but most of them had an air of apathy that she found challenging. She'd scanned through their service records. Thaddeus, Silas, Dunson, Rustam, Drino and Belus were all from the Rifles. The first four seemed solid enough. Rustam was the only other woman. She must once have had the kind of physique that would have been described as boyish before the years of service. Now she was a sandy-haired whip of a woman, stitched together with scars. She had a veteran badge on her chest and greying hair. Drino and Belus were from the last two drafts that had got off Cadia. Minka took an almost instantaneous dislike to them. She'd seen their like before. They didn't like having a woman in charge, and from their manner, she could tell that they were hyenas. They'd nip at her heels, wait until she was down, then go for her throat. The two blonde fighters were Jeremiah and Jason. They were both from the Black Dragons. They had fresh drake tattoos on their arms, the symbol of their old regiment picked out with simple barrack yard artistry. Jeremiah was a magnificent-looking man, tall and broad as a powerlifter. His medical assessment was borderline. In better years, he'd have retired to the reserves. He'd taken a bolt shell to the head 5 years back. Has squint and reduced verbal ability. Serviceable, the Medicare's report had said. Minka promised herself that she'd keep him alive. Jason seemed eager, at least. Victor Blark was the only one of her squad from the 101st. He was a thin, quiet man, still carrying a shrapnel wound from Marquis. She'd expected him to be upset about not being made sergeant, but as they lined up, he had sought her out and shaken her hand. It was a firm, friendly shake.
Congratulations.
Thanks. Better you than me. I'm honoured to be serving under you. She thought he was making a joke at first, but his face seemed sincere, and she smiled and thanked him.
Well, thanks, she said. I appreciate that.
The rest were Red Skulls. They lingered at the rear. Lasmon and Emerson. She shook their hands, and then the last man stepped forward. Arctur. He greeted her with a limp and unfriendly smile. His face seemed familiar. She looked at him for a moment, trying to think why, and then realization hit her like a splash of water. Her corporal was the Frecker from the day before. He'd shaved and washed, but it was him.
How are your balls? She said. Still think you're the joke of the Imperium?
Yes. I'm going to change your mind.
Going to kick me again?
Yes, she said. If I have to. He did not shake her hand. There was mockery in his salute as he turned and followed the others back to their barracks. By the time Minka got back to her dormitory, the M Company whistle was blowing. She cursed as she shoved a blanket and rain cape into her pack, flipped the lid closed, and ran out into the drill yard. She wasn't the last, she saw with relief. So much had changed that everyone was a little confused. At least her squad had arrived on time. She ran her eye over them. 12 troopers with their kit. She went along the line quickly. There was too much to sort out and too little time. The order came for them to stand at attention. Look smart, she ordered, and hurried to her position at the end of the line. They weren't well turned out, she knew, though they'd made something of an effort. Tyson gave them a brief going over. He was pretty gentle on the new lot. She could see him and Medicaid Banting exchanging looks as they moved through second squad. Thankfully, Minka's squad were not the worst. Arctur was there, and only Drino got a dressing down for dirt on his boots, while Jeremiah was not holding his weapon properly.
Sorry, sir, not used to the carbine, he apologised. I came from an infantry regiment. We had las rifles.
Tyson helped him get the grip right and then nodded and moved along. He gave Victor's jacket a dusting down. Troopers of the 101st were held to a higher standard. Minka tensed as he moved onto her. She braced her shoulders back until her shoulder blades were almost touching. The stripe badge on her arm was still stiff. His scrutiny ran over her, feet first.
"All good, Sergeant?" he asked at the end.
Minka gave a brief answer.
"Yes, sir."
"Keep their standards up," he said. She nodded. At that moment, there was a dull rumble. In an instant, the Cadians stiffened like a pack of hunting dogs that had caught a whiff of prey. Minka remained at attention, shoulders back, face forward. Tyson turned and looked to the guards on the parapet. There was a plume of white smoke rising into the clear blue sky above the Ever City. Another bomb, Minka thought.
"Someone find out what the hell happened there," Tyson ordered, then turned to the company and gave the order to fall out.
"You will not believe who's in my squad," Minka said. Dido didn't bother trying to guess.
"That frecker from yesterday," said Minka.
"The one you kicked?"
"Yes."
"Speak to Tyson. Get him transferred. Thrawn, I'll take him."
Minka paused.
"I can't. I mean, what will people think if I pull strings?"
"I'll sort him out and get him straight."
Dido made a face. There was a long pause.
"So, what do you think?"
"About what?"
"That explosion today. Did you hear what Tyson said?"
"Yeah, promethium fumes."
They threw their packs onto their beds, taking off their uniforms. Dido hung her jacket up at the end of her bed. One side of her mouth was lifted in a kind of smile.
"That's what the enforcers said yesterday."
Minka paused. She didn't want to be the source of unfounded rumours, but Dido was a fellow sergeant, and knowing the Astra Militarum, it would soon be common knowledge. She lowered her voice.
"Listen, Sparka told me that the Scourged are advancing faster than expected, much faster. The Navy are picketing the Delax Gap."
"Well, remember what happened last time we relied on the Navy?"
She was talking about the battle for Cadia. Dido pulled her combat jacket from the three-drawered chest at the side of their bunk and pulled it on.
"No wonder there's such a panic on. Better get your squad into shape. Looks to me like the Scourged might be here already."
"On portents?"
"Well, either that, or there's a hell of a promethium problem on this planet."
Chapter 7. The ration hall was accessed through a double staircase in the southwestern corner of the barracks. Brass chimneys vented a mix of hot air and the scent of whatever slop the chefs were serving up. Minka paused at the notice board by the doorway. Her squad were up for patrols that afternoon. She went around the long trestle tables, making sure her troopers knew.
"Parade in half an hour," she told them all.
"We've just paraded,"
Arctur said. She wanted to punch him, but smiled pleasantly.
"Yes, but this time it's in combat gear."
She should have done this earlier, Minka realised, but she'd only just been made sergeant and she was learning.
Better now than never, she told herself. Stamp her authority on them all. So, when the dozen troopers assembled, she cleared her throat and started the speech that she had been practising in her head.
"I've met you all individually, but now we're all together, I want to do this formally. For those of you who don't know, my name is Arminka Lesk, veteran of Cadia, trooper of the 101st for 3 years. This is my first command and I'm proud to be leading you. I tell you here and now that I expect the best from myself and I expect the best from my squad. I don't care what has happened before, I know what fine fighters you can all be. I want you to be the first into battle, the last to fall back. I want the dead to pile up before our lines. I want the enemy to single us out for destruction. and when the artillery bombardment begins, we will have already moved forward to engage them in combat. I want your bayonets red with the blood of heretics." She had meant for the speech to be rousing, but the response from the squad was muted. She went through their combat gear. Jeremiah was still struggling with the carbine. Rustem's bayonet was soiled around the handle, and Belus had his webbing too loose. Arctua was a mess. She stood before him and looked at him in disgust. She didn't know where to start. "Jonas Arctua, you are a corporal in the Cadian shock troopers. Look at you. Have some respect for yourself."
"I know all about respect."
"Then look like it. We're going out on patrol today. We are the head of this squad. You and me, we've got to be working together."
"Right," he said.
His tone was not conciliatory. She had said all she could without losing her cool. She moved on, but she barely saw the rest of the squad. At the end, she stood back and counted down from 10 before she made her announcement. "We're due to go out on patrol at 1700 hours. After yesterday and this morning's explosions, I think we can expect trouble. I want all eyes out for anything unusual. Full combat gear. Spare power cells. Reassemble 1600 hours. That is all." They saluted and fell out. The squad reappeared for patrol on time and with the right kit. Minka inspected the Chimera with Breve. She didn't know much about the vehicles, and she could tell that Breve was waiting to see if she knew the tricks and shortcuts that drivers used. "Listen," she said, "I don't know anything about Chimeras, except that they take me to the battle and keep me and my squad from getting killed. If you were a sergeant, then what would you look out for?" Breve showed her briefly what to look for.
"This is where the unctions are poured. Overfill it and the seals will burst. Simple error."
She was more confident with the weapon mountings. "Make sure they're oiled and armed. You got any of the new lot as crew?"
"The gunner, Jinkin."
"What's he like?"
"Seems solid."
"Great. So listen, my orders are to get out to the tent city, impose some order and assess if it's the kind of place that could be harbouring heretics. Can you take us there?" Breve laughed.
"Of course. Hard to miss it."
When her squad were ready, they piled in. Minka swung in last and helped lock the rear ramp back into place. The Chimera rocked them back and forth as they wound down the narrow Acropolis highways towards the upper level of the Evercity. Minka tried to make conversation, but each effort ended in an awkward silence. Rustem had her eyes closed, her lips moving in a prayer. Thaddeus held his bayonet up to inspect the cutting edge. It was newly oiled and wetted. He wiped an excess of oil away on his sleeve and then returned it to its sheath. Jason had a bandolier of grenades over his shoulder and was checking the launcher's magazine feed. Jeremiah was staring straight ahead. There was a twitch in the corner of his eye that he did not seem to notice. It kept tugging at the scars at the side of his eye. She had to look away. Last of all, she looked at Arctur. He had his eyes closed and mouth open. He looked as though he were about to start snoring. "Arctur," she snapped, "stay alert." Her corporal's eyes blinked open. He put a finger to his head in a desultory salute, and Minka's cheeks coloured. From the corner of her eye, she saw Drino and Belus exchange a smirk. "Freckers," she thought, and looked instinctively towards Victor. His gaze was forward at his carbine, which was freshly cleaned and polished. He felt her looking at him and glanced across the armoured interior. He said nothing, made no gesture, but she knew he was with her. She puffed out her cheeks. They were entering the upper circuits of the Evercity. She was tense. She took in a deep breath. Her shoulders ached. They wound down through the city streets for an hour.
she got brief views of the steps to once grand houses, the moulded facades now faded with sunlight, chipped by passing vehicles, or worn away by the repeated touches of many hands. She saw an old woman shelling beans into a galvanised zinc bowl, three children sitting with their chins in their cupped hands, staring as the chimera passed by, and another woman and her child sitting by the side of the street with their felt caps on the floor before them, begging. Nothing happened. No bombs. Nothing. Just general military tedium. One of those repeated patterns of life worn so deep they were a rut. At last, the chimera ended up in the broad, flat thoroughfares of the Manufactorum Quarter. Beggars squatted on each corner. The air was brown with promethium fumes, and through the razor wire, they could see gangs of indentured labourers in faded blue overalls hurrying back to their dormitory wings.
"Leaving town," Bree voxed.
They reached the end of the city. Through the thick glass of the targeting periscopes, she saw a dry moat strewn with old paper and a few pieces of broken furniture, with dirty, brown, effluent puddles in the bottom. There was the buzz of flies and the stench of rot and decay.
"Heading towards Tent City."
Arctua closed his eyes again. She kept her eye on him, just in case he fell asleep. She felt Drino and Belus watching her. After 20 minutes, Breve voxed again.
"Tent City, coming up on the left."
"Great," Minka said. Dust rose as the chimera accelerated across the flats.
"Right, something's up. Roadblock."
She flipped the vox speed on. "Who is it?"
"Not sure, but they're armed and they've driven a cargo 8 across the track."
"Get ready," she ordered. There was a taut air of alertness as the chimera started to slow. Her troopers picked up their carbines, engaged power cells, flipped the safeties off. Minka went through the same routines, checking her webbing, frag grenades, power cells, bayonet.
"Stopping in 10 seconds, Breve warned.
The Cadians were up and standing, weapons ready. At that moment, Minka remembered Tyson's instructions to her. "Get out to the Tent City. Impose some order on this planet." At this point, she realised she had no idea what exactly he had meant and how she was going to do this. All she had was one chimera and a Cadian squad against hundreds of thousands, perhaps a million, refugees. Chapter 8. The light slowly strobed Karkle's face as the hydraulic elevator ascended from the bowels of the Cossack blade. The whine of the hydraulics was deafening. The refugees from the eastern reaches of the gallows cluster all pressed close, but none of the other stowaways would stand next to Karkle. It was as if they knew what he had done down there, knew what he was. They passed disused storage chambers, the reinforced munitions galleries, then up through the habitable decks where indentured crews laboured in darkness. They had brief glimpses of abhuman stokers, lit by the glow of their furnaces, and then they were into the civilised promenades where order and protocol ruled. As the light increased, Karkle looked at his rotten clothes and leather boots. If his victim's blood stained them, then those marks were lost among the oil and filth. He rubbed at his face, and months' worth of beard matted and thick with lice and filth. He had fled his home to save himself, but now he saw that his old self had died as truly as if he had stayed on Guardia Rex. But it was not a loss, so much as a transformation. Before, he had been a lapdog. Now he was a jackal. The lift elevator platform slowed suddenly and came to a gradual halt, stopping a half inch above the metal plates of the deck. As the doors slid back, Karkle found himself at the front. His eyes lifted from the hazard warning stripes, and he saw a line of Navy ratings staring at him, their boarding shields ready. An officer stepped forward. He wore full combat gear, body armour, steel-reinforced boots and closed helmet with ornate cheek guards, and the black visor pulled down to his stubbled chin. In one hand he carried an assault shotgun, and in the other the restraining leash of a pair of cyber mastiffs. The mastiffs had bald patches where their skulls had been reinforced with ceramic plates. Tubes wormed their way into the flesh of their necks, pumping like snakes with combat stims. They dragged the officer a foot forward, mouths lowered and open in a terrifying snarl.
"Exit is that way,"
the officer shouted above the din, pointing along the broad, low metal corridor.
"Proceed with haste."
A woman screamed as the cybermastiff strained against their leashes, pulling the officer further across the metal deck plates. Their breath was a noxious combination of cheap lubricants, combat stims, and rotten meat. The crowd began to push Karkul forward. He cursed. The mastiff's breath was hot in his face. He felt spittle fly from the gnashing jaws and gagged as he pushed back against the irresistible muscle of the crowd. Bodies were thrust into the wall of boarding shields, and there was the electric crackle of a shock maul striking flesh and a shrill scream as the victim's muscles went into paralysis. A shotgun fired. The screams were all about him now. Another firearm was unloaded. Karkul felt a sting on his cheek. He was being pressed dangerously close to the animals. He slid sideways and shoved the man who had been shoving him. The man tripped and fell, and the mastiffs were on him in an instant. Karkul felt no remorse as he heard the man's cries. He pushed past the picket lines and had a brief glimpse backwards as the man disappeared into the interweaving knot of cybermastiffs. Karkul fled forward along a wide corridor, low lumen globes flickering above his head. They ran for about 100 yards. Then there were screams as they met another line of Navy ratings, shotguns ready, more cybermastiffs snarling and snapping their huge jaws shut. "Move towards the lighter," a loud hailer voice commanded. The instructions rang out from every flat surface, the walls, the low ceiling, the metal grilled floor. The crowd pushed him forward. Before him was a planetary lander with its loading ramp open. Yellow lumens flashed. More orders were being shouted. He saw more walls of boarding shields, the blank, visored faces of the Navy ratings. Another shotgun fired. The retort echoed through the cold hangar. The refugees panicked. Karkul pushed. He shoved. The crowd was pressing all about him. He felt the floor lift beneath his feet and looked down to see the worn hazard stripes of the loading ramp. Armed ratings herded them like sheep onto the landing craft. More and more were crammed inside. Karkul kept shuffling. There were men, women, children, all of them were pale and terrified. Families clung onto each other. Karkul found his place among other single young men. He felt his whole body shake with relief. He was still alive. His new home was only hours away. The wave of emotions overwhelmed him, and he started to sob like a baby. "Move forward!" The loud hailer orders kept coming. "Move forward!" Karkul felt himself being carried forward into a breathless crush. More and more refugees shoved aboard, families, gangs, impromptu groups. Karkul felt the breath squeezed from his lungs. The press began to hurt. People started to shout and scream. Karkul used his fists and knees to make enough space about him, enough room to draw breath. And then, finally, the loading ramp was shut. The darkness returned, but the sounds were different now. There was weeping and prayer and the low moan of people slipping to the ground and being slowly crushed to death as they experienced the tumult of planetary descent. The descent took nearly an hour. When, at last, the craft landed, a nervous murmur rose from the thousands inside. They had made it to the ancient capital of the Gallows Cluster, the seat of the Rich Stars. In Potence, at least, they would be safe. Some wept. Some shouted their thanks to the Holy Emperor or Saint Ignatio. Karkul closed his eyes and thought of food and warmth, of washing and of making a new start. He was safe, he told himself. That knowledge warmed him like bathwater. He was beyond the reach of the heretics who had torn his home from him. The lander settled with a roar of thrusters, and then there was a long pause as locks were disengaged and the ramp's hydraulics powered up. As the bay doors opened, he caught his first sight of this new planet. The sunlight was blinding at first, the taste of clean, fresh air restoring. He breathed it deep and stumbled forward. The crush reversed. There were shouts and cries as some were trampled underfoot. Karkul would not fall, not now, not so close to his destination. His eyes watered as he blinked in the daylight. At last he could make out white clouds stark against the violet sky and a damp scent of good earth. And, from far off, came the insistent rattle of gunfire. The outside never ceased to amaze him. All the vagaries of nature, wind, light, vegetation, horizons. Only Upheavers could afford air so pure. For a moment he felt like a rich man as he filled his lungs again and again, and then he stood on the top of the ramp and looked out and saw a dry planet and a white city on a high rock with golden domes at its rocky summit. Before him he saw women, children, fathers, each family clutching what meagre possessions they had managed to salvage from their home worlds. On the ship, their numbers had been their protection. Now he saw that numbers would be their downfall. He looked at them almost with pity. He was young, strong, capable. Times like this gave a young man opportunity. Then the gunfire started again, much closer this time, and a woman before him screamed. Chapter 9. Minka was taut as a bowstring as they approached the tent city. Breve's voice gave her the basic breakdown of the gangers at the roadblock.
There's 12 of them, 7 to the left, the rest to the right.
As soon as the Chimera stopped, Minka commanded, "Out!" She went first, number one rule of command. There were 2 gangers with intricate blue tattoos covering their faces. They had red cloths wrapped about their necks, and they wore old guard-issue flak jackets. Their cheeks bulged with grinweed. One of them cradled a grenade launcher under his arm. He grinned at her. His teeth were stained dark brown. He put a finger to his temple in a salute that oozed menace. The other was short and fat. Half of his head was shaven, while the other half was hidden behind a mop of green hair. He wore a bandolier of power cells about his neck and a broad machete at his waist. Minka trained her carbine on him.
"Who are you?"
He did not have a pleasant smile.
"I am the cartel," he said. "We are the guardians of the tent city.
Who are you?"
"Remove your checkpoint. I am Sergeant Lesk of the 101st Cadian Regiment of the Astra Militarum, of the Holy Emperor of Mankind. We proceed in his name."
"And if I say no?"
"Then we will brush you aside."
More gangers were crowding around. Their leader put out a hand and rubbed thumb and forefinger together.
"I say to you what I say to the enforcers. We charge for entry."
She lifted her carbine and aimed it at his head. Weapons down! One by one, the gangers dropped their guns, all except the commander.
I'll count to three, Minka shouted.
The ganger raised his hands to his chest in a gesture of calm.
Let me call the boss.
He turned and walked into the tent. There was a Vox unit behind the table. Minka cursed. She'd just let him dictate the pace of events. She turned. Her squad had the gangers covered. Even Breve had swung the turret round. The heavy flamer hissed as it ignited. She trained her gun back onto the gang leader.
Move slowly or I shoot, she said.
The fat ganger put one hand to the Vox unit. He lifted the receiver. Minka's hands were sweating. The seconds ticked past. Not many, but they went too slowly. Minka kept her carbine sights on the ganger's left temple. She could remain like this for hours, if need be. The man in the tent put the Vox unit down. She looked to him briefly as he turned towards them.
Right, he said, his voice rising in volume. The boss wants guarantees.
Tell him, Minka started, but at that moment someone fired. There was the flash of a lasbolt in the corner of her eye. It hit the gang leader in the thigh. He let out a snarl of pain and grabbed his pistol. In an instant, the scene erupted as gangers dived for their guns. Minka fired a double tap into the leader, throwing him into the back of the tent. The Cadians started cutting them down. A flamer went off. A Cadian screamed. The cargo aide's heavy stubber rattled as it fired. Minka threw herself forward as hard rounds slammed into the space where she had been. Thaddeus went down to a salvo from an auto pistol. Silas cursed as he dropped his gun, wounded in the arm and shoulder. She shouted orders, but there was no order to be imposed. This was up close and deadly. Only training and discipline could keep them alive. She fired with clinical speed, knocking out three gangers as they charged. The first dropped his axe. The next two howled as lasbolts burned through their unprotected guts.
Sarge! Victor shouted and pointed.
Another three were scrambling to get a missile launcher loaded and primed. She hit each of them in a deadly salvo. One shot to kill and another to make sure. As she crouched, two more gangers appeared. One carried belts of ammo over his shoulders, while the other one was a pin-headed slab of muscle who lugged a rotary cannon. She started to aim, but realised she was too late. He lowered the barrel and fired, and in an instant, the air was full of ricocheting hard rounds and swirling clouds of dust. She threw herself behind a sand-filled barrel and felt the thing shudder with successive impacts. Someone cursed.
Three troopers down! One of her squad shouted.
Minka's first command was in danger of turning into a massacre. She didn't know how many of her squad were left alive. She rolled to the side. A ganger leapt onto her back. She bent and threw him over her shoulder, put her boot on his throat and stamped down hard enough to crush his windpipe.